This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, Series 6, Episode 16, Obstacle or Opportunity? One of the things that we say quite a lot on the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show is get on with it. And I think that's a general theme for this. We answer some questions about red-green colourblindness. We talk about changing technique and when to do it and when to stick with a change. And we also discuss when people are so self-depreciating, it leads to a lack of confidence. All that and more coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. This is your guide to coaching better cricket or to playing better cricket. No matter who you are and no matter where you are, we're here to help you. And who are we? Well, my name is David Hinchliffe. I look after things here at the newly branded Pitch Vision Academy website. And with me, as always is the case, first of all, it's two guys. First of all, it's the Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Gareth.
Hello, how's everybody?
Doing fine, ready for action, enjoying the sunshine.
Yeah, absolutely. How good has it been? It's just made life so much easier, isn't it?
Oh, well, you know, to convince the groundsman to get onto the square last night for a practice session was a testament to how little rain we've had in the last 2 weeks. Because you get one drop and he's saying, no, you're going to cut the square up, get off. Speaking of enjoying the sunshine, there's a man outside at the moment. He is the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School, but he's not there now. It's Sam Lavery. Hello, Labours, where are you?
I'm at the Aegeus Bowl today. We've got a second 11 game on, and I've just been doing a little bit of analysis from last week's tournament for the school, and just watching a little bit of this, catching up with a few people, and then I'm back in school this afternoon.
Great. Well, it's a busy time of year for the three of us. It's lots of cricket going on, which is always good in this part of the world when rain looms large at any stage, even in the middle of summer. So it's great to have a good start to things. And one of the things that I've noticed since I've taken over as coach of my new club here in Glasgow is that everyone that I've spoken to so far is a thoroughly nice chap, and it's good to see a good club spirit. But I also think there's somewhat of a negative aspect to some of the niceness, and I'm talking about people being a little bit self-depreciating. We've been talking about their games, and what they've said to me is that you know, they don't feel like they're very good, or they feel like they've got a good bat that gets them out of trouble, and they talk in those kind of self-depreciating and almost negative terms. And I feel like they're self-reporting that they don't have a lot of confidence in their own game. And I think part of that is to do with the way that they're speaking. So when you have guys who are very self-depreciating and obviously lacking in confidence, how do you deal with that as a coach?
Well, I think there's two things, David, on that. One, that I don't always recognise that people that are self-depreciating don't have confidence. I think that it probably is apparent in the case that you're talking about, but it isn't always the case. You have people who are better at or take credit differently to others, and you know, a lot of the best coaches in the world, when they're given praise, for example, for something that they've achieved with their team, the first thing that they will do will be to play down their role within the whole win and all the success, and put it back onto others. So it's not always that self-depreciating people have no confidence, but say that obviously the case with your fellas may be that, and if it is that, then the way to build confidence in people that will normally look to not take any credit or not take any positives out of things is to produce facts and produce evidence which is irrefutable. So that can be, obviously, in the most basic terms, that can be our statistics for our game of cricket. But also we can do it from a practice context, you know. So, for example, I worked with somebody yesterday who did have a little confidence and is self-depreciating. I can't catch was what he was doing. And I said, well, that's really interesting, because actually we've just done a 15 catch exercise with you, and you've taken 11 of them. So actually you can catch because you've had 11 successes. And the interesting thing on that, for this lad in question, is that the previous three people who are good cricketers, would you agree with that? He said yes. I said, well, they took 9, 8 and 11 catches. So one was equal with you and the other two were not as good as you in this particular context. And the fact is that you can. And what you have to do is strip away that limiting belief. And that's a very basic example that I've given you. But in every practice scenario, if you have a player that is lacking confidence, who is self-depreciating, then the more factual we can keep things and the more we can evidence actually they are performing well, and they can put a context around it against a teammate or against a top player or somebody they consider to be a good player, that they're performing at a similar rate, then that's how you build up that confidence. You cannot argue with fact. And these guys will be self-depreciating when somebody says to them, well played, which is a bit empty, isn't it? It's got no value to it. And they'll go, oh no, well, you know, actually I played and missed three times, or I didn't feel particularly good, or whatever the case may be. We have to strip away that limiting belief when we're dealing with people with no confidence or are self-depreciating. In fact, and stats are the way to do it.
It can be the case, can't it, Lavers, that if somebody feels like they're not doing something perfectly, then they feel like they can't be effective at all. I feel like that happens quite a lot, especially at club level, where you're very limited to the amount of practice you can do, and maybe you've got flaws in your technique which are quite obvious, and there's not a lot you're going to be able to do about them. But that doesn't mean you can't be effective, but it's having the confidence to feel like you can be effective, isn't it?
Yeah, that's difficult. I think that's something we touched on last week with talking about, someone asked about perfect practice, and getting perfect practice isn't actually something we're going to achieve, and also getting perfect performance isn't something we're going to achieve either. But ultimately, I had a conversation with my under 15 group yesterday, and we've got four or five very, very good cricketers in that group. And I think sometimes the other group, and maybe in this kind of category that you were talking about here, and we actually sat them down halfway through the session and said, look, what are the roles that you feel you can play right now, and what are the roles you'd like to play? And actually, when they're realistic about it, and when we've said, right, we're happy with that agreed goal that you're going to play this role, suddenly, yes, they may not be batting at number seven and they're going out and scoring hundreds week in, week out, but the role we've given them is something slightly different. And it might be that we want to... they're going to play a role of having maintaining a strike rate throughout a period of time, or trying to make sure they're always turning over the strike, or something very, very simple like that. And suddenly they become good at their role because their role isn't what they thought it was. And sometimes batters think their role is scoring hundreds, and bowlers think their role is taking fifers. And that's not always the case. So in giving them some facts and some evidence, as Gareth has said, that straight away makes them stand up and listen. And sometimes just varying their role a little bit to make it a little bit more achievable for them will help along the way as well.
That role is an interesting point, isn't it? Because you do get times when you have a chance to fill in a specific role and do that for an extended period of time. And there are also going to be times when someone drops out of the first team at the last minute, and you're called into the first team, maybe not because you're in any kind of form, but just because you were available at the last minute. And then you bat in a completely different place, or you bowl in a completely different time in the match, and suddenly you're not filling your role anymore. And the way you respond to that as well is an important aspect to your confidence, isn't it?
Yeah, outlining your expectations each time is something that's going to be key, and it's going to probably help people that what's being asked of them is more achievable, and that can maybe give them a little bit of confidence.
And it goes back, Gareth, to your idea of saying, well, you know, let's get on with it. It's not a perfect situation. You know, I'm batting at number seven this week when I've been batting at three for the last 5 weeks, but and it's the last minute. No one's told me about it. The captain's just pointed to you, gone seven. You know, how do you respond? Do you go, oh, well, I'm definitely going to fail because I'm not doing my role? Or do you say, I'm going to get on with it and I'm going to do what I can to achieve what I can with the opportunity I've got?
Well, it's about looking at things as opportunities rather than challenges or hurdles, isn't it? And I had a conversation, ironically, with the brother of the high catchy guy the other day, who played for Somerset under-17s against our school the other day. Lost by 260 runs, but, you know, that we won't hold that against him. He batted at eight, and he felt that he was batting behind people who were not as good as him, that he could bat better than. And I said to him, well, you know, you go out there and you think like that, and then you're going to fail ultimately. Or do you go out there and say, this is a brilliant opportunity, because the first team were bowling out the Somerset side fairly cheaply. You've got plenty of overs to go, and you've got an opportunity to bat 20 overs. The number that you go in is irrelevant. You've still got 120 balls left in the game, and you've got a great opportunity to build an innings. And he went out there and Wells probably didn't bat this way. He didn't bat all the way through. He took 12 overs out of the game, got himself a bit of a score, which has helped him in the pecking order with Somerset, but also probably showed our coaches here at school that there's a little bit more batting behind in than they previously thought. So it's about looking at things as opportunities rather than as a challenge or an issue or whatever the case may be.
Let's wrap up this section with the yes-no round. Three questions that can only be answered yes or no, no matter how much more that the members of the team want to say. And I've got the questions this week, so let's go. First question. Pressure is a reflection of ambition.
Yes.
No.
Second question. The power play is the key.
No.
Third question. James Anderson is England's greatest swing bowler.
No.
Yes.
Let's head into the mailbag now. This is the section where you send in your questions as a listener or a reader to the Pitch Vision Academy website. And we do our very best to answer those questions as thoroughly as time allows. And then at the end, we pick a winner of the prize, which is an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. So you can send your questions into us by emailing coach@pitchvision.com, or there are other methods which we will tell you about towards the end of the show. And the first person who has emailed in is Christian. And Christian says, one in 20 men are red-green colourblind, including myself. How can we bat on grounds with no sight screens and trees in the background?
I'm also red-green colourblind, Christian, as too is Ian Botham. Both of us grew up on cricket grounds with no sight screens. I grew up on a cricket ground that, even with sight screens, they're pretty useless because they're so high above the playing surface that they're there for decoration rather than actual practicality. Beefy grew up in some parks, really, you know, playing cricket. Now, whether they were wood-lined and had trees all around the outside or not, I'm not sure. But certainly from my perspective, I played without sight screens and with a green background as well. I hear this question a lot. To me, it's a bit of a cop-out, I have to say, that we think that we can't see it, because the contrast between the two is significant. And however colorblind we are, the fact that the edge of the ball is a contrast to whatever background it's coming out of. So I think we can overplay the colorblindness, and I think, again, it's a bit like the limiting beliefs that we talked about in our introduction when we were talking about self-depreciating players. We want to try and cut away those limiting beliefs. So to me, if you focus on the ball, then you will see, whether it be a soft focus or a real narrow focus, you will be able to see the contrast of a ball up against that tree. There's only one time in my whole career where I lost a ball, and that was when it came in from a throw-in. And I can't tell you whether it came out of a tree or a building or whatever, but I literally lost the ball completely. And it hit me smack bang in my left pec as it came in flat. Fortunately, it didn't take out my beautiful face. Otherwise, all the girls of the Isle of Wight would have been trembling about that one, obviously. But that was the only time I ever lost it. Now, so I think there's ways around it, which is just adjusting your focus. But really, there shouldn't be any real challenge with it. And I always say to anybody that says this to me, well, I managed to cope with it. So if I can do it, then it means that most other people can do it. And Surian Botham certainly managed to do that in his formative years playing cricket around the Somerset cricket grounds. And lots of them haven't got side screens either. So to me, it's a bit of a cop-out. I can't give you any strategies. I just think you've got to try and find a way to put this sort of distraction of being colourblind to the back of your mind. And you'll be probably not surprised to hear me say, just get on with it.
I am not red-green colourblind, but I have definitely experienced what must be a similar feeling, in that if you're playing on a ground, which as I don't know if it's a common parlance, but certainly something I've heard relatively recently, is it's not a very good seeing ground. The ones with the dark trees in the background and the ball is getting quite old and it's getting a little bit darker towards the end of the game, and it's much harder to see the darker red ball against the darker trees in the background. They're almost black in the background. So I guess it must be a similar kind of experience where you have to really, really concentrate to pick up the ball. Lavers, have you had anyone come to you asking for advice on this kind of a problem?
I haven't actually. However, going back to something Gareth mentioned earlier on, I think it's another thing that you can look at in one of two ways. It's either an obstacle or a hurdle to get over, or it's an opportunity, or it's a challenge for you. So, if we're honest, is it easier or is it more difficult? It probably is a little bit more difficult. But is it impossible? Absolutely not. So again, it's another challenge. And just like you'd be challenged because you want to develop your game on the front foot, or you want to develop your ability to play a pull shot, you want to develop your fielding, your fitness or whatever, it's another challenge. You've got to try and work on it. And you're going to have to work out a strategy that's going to suit you. You may actually find that something suit you better. So maybe the shorter ball, which then goes into the whiteness of the pitch, is something you can pick up sooner. I'm not sure. I'm not in a position where I've experienced necessarily, but you might find that. But in terms of an opportunity, if you can perform against it, no doubt you're going to then play a higher level of cricket because you're going to be successful. And I guess you're aiming towards playing at a level of cricket where the sight screens are there suddenly. So in which case, you've worked very hard playing at a level of being successful without them. And when they suddenly do arrive, you may find that, yes, the level of cricket is a little bit more challenging. However, suddenly viewing the ball is even easier. So you might find a really good transition into a higher level of cricket when you do get there.
I think that's a great point, you know, because as I said, myself and Ian Botham, obviously a much better player than me, managed to do all right with it. And there's numerous others out there that have got over these challenges. And we all started, didn't we, playing on cricket grounds, or sometimes playing on cricket grounds that didn't have sight screens. The other thing I'd say is, as well, my dad's got one eye and he adapted to that. And I coached a lad the other week over in St. Lucia. And I know that his dad will be listening to the show because he listens every week. And he also has only got one eye, but yet is copes fantastically with it. So all of these things, going back to Sam's point, are challenges, but we should see it as an opportunity to develop something else and to find a way of trying to be successful. And people have done it down the years. So again, it can be a bit of a crutch, a bit of a cop-out to say, this is my challenge, my affliction, my this, that, my that. But really, the great thing about cricket is throughout the whole history of the whole of our game, people have overcome challenges to enjoy their cricket first and foremost, and in some cases to do some really good things on the pitch.
I don't know if you know this, Gareth, but are there degrees of red-green colour blindness? Can some people have it worse than others?
Well, the only way of telling it in a normal way, I suppose, is, you know, those dot tests that we all had when we were kids, where it's obvious to people that are normal sighted that there's letters or numbers or whatever the case may be within those dots. And those dots aren't just the same configurations going through. There's different degrees of colours mixed up to try and find that. I mean, from my point of view, when I did my colour blindness test, and I've done it a few times now, but the first time I did it, there are 20 cards that you look at. I got to the 19th. I was bawling my eyes out because I literally couldn't see anything, and I thought that there was something horribly wrong with me. And the woman turned around to me and she said, it's a number, and it's not odd, and it's between 1 and 3. And I said, it's number 2. And she said, congratulations, you're 95% colorblind. So, you know, I was completely, I had no idea what was going on. It was probably the most frustrating 6 or 7 minutes of my life, because I just couldn't see anything. But I also know that there are people that, for certain ones of them, because of the way that the cards are coded, would see some, but not others as well. So there are different degrees of it. But any more than that, I can't give you. I can just talk from my own horrible experience that still wakes me up with cold sweats some nights.
And I suppose if you can give that, that's a really good example, because if you are just about as bad as it gets within the colorblindness universe, and you can still get to a point where you played a decent level of cricket, then that's a perfect example. And maybe the percentage of people who have your level of colorblindness are less likely to get through, but it's just another challenge, a different challenge from what other people have.
And then that's the way to look at it. You know, it's challenges and it's opportunities, isn't it? And if we view things in those ways, I'm sure that Christian and anybody else out there that's listening that's got red-green colour blindness will look at their problem and their challenge in a slightly different way as a result of listening to this.
Next question is from Matt. And Matt says, as coaches, what approach do you take when you facilitate a change to a player's technique and it fixes one problem but leads to a different problem? And he's very kindly given us a little bit of a backstory, so I'll give you that as well. He says, last season and going into the nets this winter, the biggest struggle I had was consistently bringing my bat down straight. I had the tendency to play across the line around the ball. With a bit of coaching, I've worked on changing my setup. My front arm used to be rigid and my hands out away from my body, and I've now got a front arm that's bent and a top hand tucked into my back hip. Happily, this worked. I'm more compact and I'm playing straighter. However, I don't feel quite as balanced at the crease, and I've developed a tendency to fall over slightly. I'm worried that I might be an LBW candidate. I've briefly experimented with using a trigger movement to try and get myself steady and ready to move. It's been interesting, but I'm quite cautious about tying myself in knots with more technical changes at this point. So I'm interested in what things you think about when advising a player whether to be patient with a change, you're still getting used to it, or to make a further change.
Great, great background. Really useful in the way that we can attack this question. And there's a number of things that come out because of the depth that you've got into. For me, whenever we're doing any coaching, I think one of the dangers of coaching is that we always look for a solution. We always look for something that's going to help somebody out. And often we don't spend enough time really analysing what the challenge is and most importantly, what the root cause is of something happening. And so we give people a bit of advice and then they go away and work on it, and it opens up other areas of technical challenge that you speak of here. To me, you've got to have a look. You've got to be patient when you look. You talk about patience for the player. You've also got to be patient when you look as well. And make sure that you get to the root cause of whatever's going on. So the best coaches I've worked to say absolutely nothing for a long time, because whilst they're quiet, they're working out what the key thing is, and they will give you one thing for you to work on. And often, because they've thought about it so much and they are a good coach, it's not a throwaway comment. It isn't the most obvious thing that's out there. It is the thing that's going to make the difference. So taken away from batting here, I would say from a bowling perspective, people always look at wrist positions, because that's the last bit that we see in anybody bowling action. And you hear a lot of people talking about, oh, I'm working on my wrist position. But often the wrist position is the consequence of what's gone on before. And what's gone on before in the bowling action is a consequence of what's happened possibly in the bound strike or in the run-up. So if you go back to the root cause, then you've got more chance of things working really well further down the chain. So I'm not sure that you've hit your root cause here. The slight struggle that I've got is when you change the alignment of a batting stance very significantly, then you're likely to change the way that the person can visually perceive the ball coming in, can recognise the visual cues of a bowler, and offset balance. So to me, by changing your stance from what you're normally used to, from your preference that we talk about a lot on this show, you've probably dealt with the back going back a little bit straighter and coming down a bit straighter, but you've opened up a can of worms in terms of your balance and maybe even your perception of the ball coming out of the hand as well. So it's a difficult one for me to give you some individual stuff on what you need to do, but my point initially is get to the root cause of any problem rather than just look to tinker and sort a straight back lift and downswing out, because often that can lead to bigger challenges later on. The second bit about the player for me is, yes, we do need to be patient, because I think Steph Jones wrote a really good bit on how people learn, and it goes through that whole process, like when we learned to drive the other day, you know, where everything's really conscious and clunky to start off with, and then, you know, 5 years on, when we're driving along the road, we get to our destination without remembering any one of our gear changes or indications or whatever, and we've got to be patient through that process as a driver, and we've got to be patient through that process when we're doing some technical changes with people as well. You know, we've got to do it bit by bit and work them through that state where everything is really conscious and slow and clunky, through to where you've got somebody like Jimmy Anderson now who can just run up and bowl and not think about action and just end up doing whatever he wants with a cricket ball. You know, he's at the end of the stage, but he had to work all the way through those different stages in order to get there. So we do need to be patient, but I think the key point with any technical change is getting the first thing right, the root cause, rather than tinkering. And it sounds to me that you might be tinkering with that backswing thing. I'd be interested to see where that came from, the whole backswing situation. He's tended to play across the line and around the ball. Was that something that you recognised, or was that something that we got told to you? Because I see a lot of players being told that their backswing is too far out, and yet we see people like Amla and various others coming across the ball, but their last bit is straight, you know. So that to me is an interesting one. What was the real history? So the backstory: last season you were coming around the ball. Who told you that? Was that you, or was that somebody else telling you? Because I'd be interested in that to start off with. But root cause, and then be patient.
Yeah, it's interesting that he didn't report any problems with his game in terms of, you know, I wasn't getting any runs, or since I've made the change, I've been getting at LBW. The way he reported it was, I had a technical fault, I changed my technical fault, and now I'm worried that I've got another one. He didn't actually say at any point what the outcome was in terms of runs or losing his wicket. So that's interesting that he's coming from that perspective rather than the perspective of, well, was what I was doing before working, and is what I'm doing now working? He's just thinking it purely from a comparison to the textbook almost.
And you look at somebody like Steve Smith now, you know, how good a cricket is he playing? Yet his top of backswing points out to gully. And in the years gone by, people have just gone, well, that can't be right. You know, you've got to get your hands back. But the challenge with getting your hands straight is that often, and Marcus Trescothick is a great example of this, he used to work really hard on getting his backswing right. But often by doing that, he'd end up pulling it round the back of him a little bit. And so in order to get to the back to the ball, he would have to come round his body. And, you know, when you've got a body the shape of a pear anyway, it's not easy to get your hands around it. And as a result, he would often come around himself slightly. And somebody like a McGrath or an Ambrose with that unnerving accuracy would really bring that outside edge into play as a result. And that was all down to the fact that he wanted to have his hands in close and his back going really straight back and then hopefully straight forward. But by doing that, he was causing his own own downfall, really. So I'm not necessarily bothered about the top of backswing stuff. It's all about the last, if you think about a video camera, the last four frames leading into contact. If the hands come back in, which is what Steve Smith does, which is what Amler does, and the backswing comes down for those last four, then I haven't got a problem with it, because that's the key time. So yeah, I mean, going back to my point, why did you make the change? I get the sense that somebody said to you, your top backswing's too high and you're coming at it too wide and you're coming across it. You know, what was the outcome? What was the reason why you really changed it? You know, what was happening with your game? That would be it. And then root cause and be patient when you're doing any change.
It is easy, isn't it, Lavers, to, if you see someone who's doing something that doesn't look right, it's very easy to give in to the temptation of saying to that person, that doesn't look right to me, you know, your backswing's in the wrong place, your hands are in the wrong place, before you've really had time to think about it and decide whether that's the problem or not.
Yeah, I think getting to know someone's the key, isn't it, first of all? So know how it works for them in a net session. Also know how it works for them in a match situation, and consider what the value of that is and what the value of changing it would be. So you do really need to get to know someone before you go in and start making significant changes. And Gavras gave a great example there, and there are dozens of them on TV. So if you just watch any IPL game, any test match, you will see that the majority of the players have got little areas where they could be technically better in theory. However, they've got things that work for them. And the easy one you can always look at is someone like Shanderpool or someone like Malinga, and most people wouldn't coach it. But ultimately, we're trying to coach towards an outcome, and the outcome is how many runs he scores or how many wickets he takes. And if you've got a method that's working, then yes, you may try and develop it further, but it doesn't mean it has to change. There's not necessarily a blanket right answer and a blanket wrong answer. So I guess that's something that coaches need to be a little bit more aware of, and probably something that we all did when we were a little bit younger and a little bit more naive as coaches. We do the same sort of thing. I know I probably did. Okay, so from the glorious sunshine of the Aegeus Bowl down in Hampshire to no doubt the bitter cold of Glasgow, David's turn for the soapbox today. So 60 seconds, David, off you go.
17 degrees, not a cloud in the sky, but I'm not going to talk about that. It's Steve Peters that I wanted to talk about, the chap behind the excellent book, The Chimp Paradox, which I think was recommended on this very show by one of you other chaps. And one of the things that he talks about in that book is life being unfair. And if you accept that life is unfair, which I think everybody can accept, then that helps you accept when things don't go exactly according to plan. So sort of tying back into the general theme of this show, really, which is, as Gareth says, you have to get on with things even if things aren't going perfectly. It's reasonable to think that you should be treated fairly in situations when you're playing in club cricket or playing for your teams, but it's also reasonable to think that there are times when that's not going to happen, and your response to it is the only thing you've got control over, really. So respond to it in a positive way and get on with it, and you'll be a lot happier. And that is the end of the show for this week. We've got some things we're going to do before we head off, the first one of which is to decide on the winner of this week's competition. As you recall, it's an online coaching course, courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And the two contenders for the question this week were Christian's question about red-green colourblindness and Matt's question about changing technique and when you should start and when you should stop. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
I love Christian's question because it's related to something that I could talk to from a personal perspective. But this week, Matt wins it. Great question. Loads of detail in the backstory, which was very useful. And there's a load of good batting courses that you can choose from. The Graham Gooch one being the most up-to-date one, which I think is would be a great starting point for anybody. If you're going to get one batting pitch vision course, that is the one.
Yeah, congratulations to you. And if there are other people listening to the show who feel like they want to get the same kind of prize, then the way to do that is send your question into us. you'll definitely, if it's read out on the show, you'll definitely get an answer from the team, and you may even win that prize as well. And you can enter, of course, as many times as you like. Gareth, how would somebody get in touch with the show?
They could give us a call on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email at coach@pitchvision.com.
That's correct. Our Twitter is at pitchvisionacad, and you can find us on Facebook by going to facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy. You can also go to our website, which I haven't mentioned very much on the show, but it's got a brand new look, new logos, new design, so it's all very exciting over there. You can find out more about subscribing to the podcast by going over to there. It's pitchvision.com/academy. You can find out all the places that the podcast can be downloaded from and whatever app you want to use. Or you can get the show notes, or you can stream it live on the website. And that's all for this week. We hope you listen next week. But until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Cheers, fellas.
Cheers, guys.